The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I know some of you, but not all of you. I'm Toby Gordon Dichter, and for 7 years I was the chair of the foundation board. And now that Barbara Sutherland is capably and inspirationally taking over as chair, I'm just a proud member of the board of directors and the board of trustees. The library is unusual. It's governed by both an independent city agency, managed by its own board of trustees, and also by a separate nonprofit organization, the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation. So sponsoring this lecture series in my mother's honor is really bringing such joy to our lives. If you think that the pleasure that you get from the library has brought to your life and its profound return on investment to everyone in this city, I believe at your end, you too will want to make a philanthropic contribution in your life to this library as well. So a Philadelphia bibliophile and a Times of London columnist walk into a bar. Well, not really. It was Jay Sheeky's restaurant in London on a rainy Thursday 7 years ago. Ben McIntyre had invited me for lunch because he was out the day I'd spent at the Times of London, thanks to a very thoughtful bidder at a silent auction. I had just finished devouring McIntyre's latest bestseller, Agent Zigzag, about a Nazi double agent, and realized this guy was Edward R. Murrow and John le Carré in one. You are there, minute by minute, in true stories of astounding British espionage. As a foreign correspondent in the 1980s, Ben traveled widely in war-torn Afghanistan, and then the paper sent him to other war-torn places like Washington, D.C. Perhaps that helped his deep sense of humor and irony. As The Guardian said of his famous book, Philby, A Spy Among Friends, which I so recommend, McIntyre writes with the insight of a journalist and the panache of a born storyteller. And it's true of all 12 of his books. Four, including Operation Mincemeat, the true spy story that changed the course of World War II, were made into BBC documentaries, and it has 17,000 views on YouTube, that documentary. You can get it now. The Spy and the Traitor tells the story of the real-life Russian double agent, Oleg Gordievsky. The Soviet Union's top man in London for more than a decade, who, after the Berlin Wall fell, he was so disgusted with the nation's communist system that it led him to work covertly with Britain's MI6 and turn the tables on the KGB. I warn you not to read the photo captions when you buy the book right away, because it's a thriller to the very end. So I hope that you enjoy it as much as I do. And if you don't get the chills on page 181, it means you're not reading the newspapers. You'll see. In the glowing review, the Washington Post wrote, "The Spy and the Traitor arrives at a moment when the machinations of Russian intelligence are the subjects of almost daily news stories." And that's why I'm saying this book is so relevant. It called him the preeminent popular chronicler of British intelligence history because he understands that real espionage is the opposite of James Bond gunplay. And panache, it's about waiting, planning, shadowing, and hiding. Fortunately, Mr. McIntyre is not hiding tonight, and there's no need for us to wait, so let us welcome Ben McIntyre to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much, Toby. What a lovely introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. You see here Oleg Antonievich Gordievsky. This is a photograph taken in the safe house where Oleg has been for the last 33 years. He is under extremely tight protection. even more secure in the last in recent months since the attempted poisoning of Sergei Skripal in Salisbury. He cannot leave the house alone. He has a permanent bodyguard there 24 hours a day. He is, in a way, a sort of captive of history, Oleg. He, as Toby said, for more than a decade, Oleg Gordievsky, as a rising star within the KGB, the Soviet intelligence service, spied secretly for Britain. It was an incredibly dangerous and brave thing to do. The stakes couldn't have been higher. If Oleg had ever been rumbled by the KGB, he would have been arrested, he would then have been interrogated and tortured and shot. So really, he was risking his life, and I'll tell you a little bit more about why he did that shortly. I first met Oleg about 5 years ago when I decided to start researching this story. One of the extraordinary things about Gordievsky is that he has an amazing photographic memory. One of the things that they were taught at Soviet spy school was to memorize vast amounts of material. And Oleg is one of those people that will tell you what it smelled like in a particular room in the Lubyanka in 1962. And he will remember it very clearly. And if you ask him the same question a year later, he will give you exactly the same answer. He is a phenomenal resource in that way, and quite unlike anyone that I've ever interviewed before. Towards the end of the research process in this book, I was going to see Oleg in the safe house about once a month, and then latterly about once a week. I gathered probably about 150 hours of recorded interviews with him, an extraordinary archive which I'm now going to give to the Imperial War Museum. Through Oleg, I was also able to meet and interview all the MI6 officers who ran Oleg in the course of his career as a double agent. Now, that is itself rather remarkable, because MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service, its officers sign a lifelong oath of silence. They sign the Official Secrets Act. They're not supposed to talk about this stuff. But they did. They did talk to me, and clearly they did so with authorization from above. They would not have been able to do so if MI6 had not given them permission to talk to me. So that itself is, well, that's the extent of the collusion that I had with the intelligence services, but without it, I would not have been able to write this book. The espionage usually doesn't make an enormous amount of difference, by which I mean that good intelligence can oil the wheels of traditional diplomacy. If it's done well, it can make us all safer. If it's not done well, it can make us all markedly more unsafe. But very seldom do spies actually change strategically what states are doing. Oleg is the exception to that broad rule. He was producing intelligence of such high quality that it was materially altering what Margaret Thatcher was doing in 10 Downing Street and what Ronald Reagan was doing in the Oval Office. It was actually changing the course of history, and it began to pave the way for the beginning of the end of the Cold War. We think of spies as adversarial creatures always. Actually, spies can be forces for peace. That Oleg should have become a double agent for the British is itself very extraordinary, because he was born into the KGB. His brother was a KGB officer. You see him here on the right, Vasily, his older brother. His father was a KGB officer on the left, a KGB officer of such dedication that he even wore his uniform at weekends, as you can see here. Anton Gordievsky, the father, was one of the earliest members of the NKVD, which was the predecessor, Stalin's predecessor to the KGB. Anton Gordievsky had seen some pretty horrible things in the 1930s and had participated in quite a number of them. He had a considerable amount of blood on his hands. And that, I think, is one of the triggers, one of the keys to Oleg's behavior, is that although he loved his father very much, he regarded him, rightly in fact, as being what he called Homo Sovieticus, somebody who was completely imbued with all the nostrums of communist life, who never questioned the party's judgments, and who was in every way an old-fashioned Stalinist. And in some ways, Oleg was rebelling against exactly that. Oleg was an extraordinarily gifted school student. He did incredibly well at his school. He was particularly good at languages. He graduated in the top of his class. This is his graduation, high school graduation diploma, with, as you can see, Lenin and Stalin still on it. He graduated top of his class. Oleg never really considered being anything other than a KGB officer. He was born into the KGB. He ate KGB food. They lived in a KGB compound. Now, we think of the KGB today, rightly, as being a vast machinery of ruthless Stalinist oppression, which it was. But it was also, if you were talented and ambitious enough, an elite that very few were allowed to join. In the end, it had about 1 million people in it, if you counted all the informants and so on. But to be a KGB officer was to be the creme de la creme. And Oleg was determined to become, as his brother had before him, a KGB officer. He attended Moscow State University, which is often described as the Harvard of the Soviet Union. It was the top, the most elite of the schools. There he studied languages. He learnt German, he learnt Swedish, he also learnt Danish, and he learnt a bit of English, which he would then improve later on. He also joined the university track team, the long-distance running team. Now, the reason I show you this photograph is that, in a way, long-distance running is a kind of leitmotif for Gordievsky's life. All the decisions that he took over the course of his career, both while within the KGB and latterly when he had begun to work for MI6, were taken alone. He was somebody who, and still is somebody, who really does exercise, as it were, the loneliness of the long-distance runner. Oleg didn't need other people to arrive at his judgments. But more practically speaking, it was while he was in the university track team that he met a man who would play a very important role in his life. On the left here, you see, that's Oleg there. But this man was a Czech trainee intelligence officer called Stanislaus Kaplan. Now, Kaplan was not like the other students at Moscow State University. It would be wrong to say he was a dissident exactly, but he was certainly a questioner. He was one of the very few people who really began to look quite closely at what the Soviet system was. And he and Oleg became very close friends. And late at night, they would discuss in an undertone and secretly where they thought the Soviet Union was going wrong and where they thought it might go right. Stanislaus Kaplan will play a very important part in the story that follows. Oleg joined the KGB while he was still at university. There was, in fact, a recruiting center within the university. And in his final year before graduation, he was sent to East Germany, to East Berlin. And he was there on a kind of translating job, really. But the morning after he arrived, in August 1961, he looked out of his bedroom window in the KGB enclave in Karlshorst and saw hundreds of bulldozers pouring into the city with thousands of East German soldiers and literally thousands of miles of barbed wire to start building the Berlin Wall. So he watched the first foundations go down. And he was profoundly shocked. One of the things that he'd been able to do while a student at university was he did have access to Western newspapers and magazines. So he knew a little bit about what the West was really about, although those magazines were very carefully censored. And the building of the Berlin Wall showed Oleg in the most dramatic way that East and West were being divided by a physical rampart. The Berlin Wall was referred to in East Berlin, which, of course, East Germany was a satellite subjugated state, really, of the Soviet Union, was described in East Germany as the anti-fascist protection wall. It was there to keep the evils of capitalism out of the Soviet socialist paradise. Of course, to anyone with half a brain, and Oleg had considerably more than that, it was clearly a prison wall. It was there to keep East Germans inside, because they had been leaving East Germany at a prodigious rate, and the East German government was terrified that effectively the whole country was going to empty. So that was the first moment when Oleg began to realize that the propaganda on which he'd been raised from a very early age was probably not true. It didn't stop him, however, from becoming a KGB officer. He went to the elite Red Banner Training School, which was also known as School 101, believe it or not, an unconscious echo of George Orwell's Room 101. There he was introduced to all the refined techniques of Soviet spycraft. Dead drops, dead letterboxes, coding, signal sites, and evasion. Surveillance and evasion. Now, in Russian, this is known as proverka, which literally means dry cleaning. And the art of being able to slip away from people who are following you was known as dry cleaning. And Oleg turned out to be a champion dry cleaner, something that would also prove very important in the story that follows. Oleg was first deployed to Directorate S of the KGB. Now, this is the Lubyanka. This was the KGB headquarters in Moscow. It was formerly an insurance company building. It's rather beautiful, actually, but it was also an incredibly sinister place. The basement contained the torture cells, where victims would have the truth beaten out of them, or more often, the non-truth beaten out of them. Oleg worked on the fifth floor in Directorate S. Now, Directorate S ran illegals. There are two types of spy in Russian nomenclature. There are legals and illegals. Legals are KGB officers deployed to the West under diplomatic cover. So they would be working technically as kosher diplomats, while in fact running KGB business. Illegals are a different variety of spies. Illegals are civilians who are trained to melt into foreign countries as if they were citizens of those countries. And they usually went equipped with false identities, false backgrounds. And Oleg was in charge of really helping to create the identities of these people, this vast army of covert citizens, whose job was to both gather intelligence, but also to wait for the Third World War that Russia believed was coming, where they would act as a fifth column. Oleg was very frustrated in this job. He was very keen to get out, to get on the road, and to become an illegal, as his brother Vasily had already become. His big break came in 1967, when he was deployed to Denmark as a KGB officer, although he was technically, cultural attaché in the Soviet embassy. And he adored Denmark. The arrival in Denmark in the West was a complete eye-opener for Oleg. Oleg is a man of high culture. And the discovery that there were books and classical music and other newspapers and so on that he could read in Denmark that he would never have had access to in the Soviet Union was a revelation to him. And he adored Denmark, and he settled in there very quickly, running a very large group of illegals inside the Danish society. But everything changed for Oleg in 1968 when the great Czech reform movement, known as the Prague Spring, which was the liberalizing movement under Alexander Dubček that tried to create in Czechoslovakia socialism with a human face. And a lot of young Russians, including Oleg, believed that this was going to be the shape of the future for the communist states. So when in August 1968, Soviet tanks rolled into Prague to crush the Prague Spring and destroy the reform movement, Oleg was outraged. He took it actually as a personal affront. And it caused him to do something that in retrospect was both extremely brave, but also quite stupid. He went to a telephone inside the Soviet embassy that he knew was bugged by the Danish intelligence service. Now, the Danish intelligence service, known as PET, was very small but very efficient. And he knew that this telephone, anything on that telephone would be eavesdropped on by the Western intelligence services. He also knew that his own home telephone was bugged. So he rang his wife at home. His wife, Yelena, was a fellow KGB officer. They were not getting on very well, and the marriage was soon dissolved. But he rang her at home and delivered a harangue against the Soviet government for crushing the Prague Spring. Because he believed that PET, the Danish intelligence service, would pick it up, and then they would realize that Oleg was not quite the obedient KGB yes man that he appeared to be. The problem with this plan was that the Danish intelligence service completely missed it. Quite why they didn't pick up this signal has never really been clearly explained. There was a whole blizzard of things happening when the Prague Spring was going on, but they missed it. However, they did already have Oleg Gordievsky under surveillance. This is part of a set of photographs I discovered in Oleg's attic about a year ago. These are photographs taken by PET, covertly. Oleg has no idea he was being photographed. And the reason, this is another one taken from a fixed camera attached to a lamppost in a street in Copenhagen. That's Oleg there on the left. The reason they were following Oleg was quite interesting. They had already realized that he was a KGB officer. And he was spotted towards the end of 1968 going to the red light district in Copenhagen, going to a bookshop there and buying a number of gay pornographic magazines. Now, to PET, to the Danish intelligence service, this looked like an opportunity. Because if Oleg was secretly homosexual, that was an opportunity for blackmail. And so they launched one of the oldest and nastiest operations in espionage, the honey trap. They sent a young Dane to try to chat up Oleg at a party and see if he could lure him into seduction when they would take photographs and then blackmail him. This plan completely failed for the very simple reason that Oleg wasn't gay. Homosexuality was illegal in the Soviet Union, and Oleg later explained that he'd bought the magazines to take home to show his wife because they didn't know what homosexuality was. And in fact, they put them on the mantelpiece. So, needless to say, the honey trap failed. So the first two attempts by either side to make contact, to try and, you know, establish some sort of way of working with each other, completely failed. But a year later, Stanislaus Kaplan, the runner that I mentioned to you earlier, defected to the West. Kaplan was also enraged by the crushing of the Prague Spring and decided he could no longer live in Czechoslovakia. He was now a fully-fledged Czech intelligence officer. He fled to the West, and he wound up in London, where he was debriefed by MI6, Britain's Foreign Intelligence Service. Now, it was convention in those days that every defector would be asked, is there anybody else, do you know anybody else in your circle who might also be against the Soviet regime? And Stander Kaplan said, yes, there's one person that you should think about trying to recruit, and that is Oleg Gordievsky, because he's a little like me. So this was the first time in British intelligence files that Oleg's name was flagged up as a potential recruit to the other side. Oleg was sent back to Moscow for a period of about 3 years. Then he was redeployed to Denmark. And when he came back to Copenhagen in 1972, the British and the Danes were waiting for him. So at this point, I want to introduce you to a character who was the head of the MI6 station in Copenhagen called Richard Bromhead. Now, Richard Bromhead was, and he's still alive, I'm delighted to say, he's in his 90s now. He's one of those lovely upper-class, hail fellow, well-met Englishman, a public schoolboy who would slap you on the back and offer you another drink. He spent an awful lot of time trying to appear to be a lot more stupid than he really was. Richard Bromhead was a very formidable intelligence officer. And he slowly began to try to reel in Oleg Gordievsky. A long and very elaborate courtship started, during which Richard Bromhead would invite Oleg to lunch, Oleg would invite Richard Bromhead to lunch. They would obliquely discuss what they were doing without ever quite admitting that each of them were intelligence officers on either side of the Cold War. In fact, the courtship was so subtle that at one point Richard Bromhead sent a message back to MI6 saying, I'm really worried, I think Oleg Gordievsky is trying to recruit me. Eventually, after about a year of this, it became quite clear that Oleg Gordievsky was prepared to cooperate with MI6. Now, why did he do this? Most spies operate for a variety of motives. Romance, adventure, frequently money. Money is often the most important element in a kind of spy transaction of this sort. Oleg made it clear from the very beginning that he didn't want money. He actively said, I do not wish to be paid. I'm doing this because I believe it. Oleg is not unburdened with a sense of his own historical importance. Oleg believed that he was in a unique position to be able to inflict major damage on the KGB and therefore bring down a regime that he had come to think of as corrupt, ruthless, brutal, and philistine. So he's one of the very few spies I've ever come across who is almost 100% ideological. And from this moment on, Oleg began to produce really a vast amount of material for Western intelligence. One of the reasons he was able to do this was because he was very close friends with the resident, that is the technical term for the head of a KGB station, who was a man called Mikhail Lyubimov. You see him here on the right-hand side of the picture. Now, Lyubimov was a very interesting and clever and sort of gentle soul in lots of ways, and he trusted Oleg completely, which meant that Oleg had access to a huge amount of material that he would never have had otherwise. He began to take from the diplomatic bag every week when it arrived from Moscow key elements of instructions from the center, from the Lubyanka, and then distribute this to MI6. Now, some of the things he was producing were very remarkable. For example, he was able to identify this man on the left, whose name was Arne Treholt, who was a rising star of the Norwegian Labour Party. Denmark was really regarded by the KGB as being the kind of central node for intelligence gathering in the whole of the Scandinavian region. So they were very much across what was going on in Norway and Sweden and so on. Arne Treholt was tipped by many people to be the next prime minister of Norway, but Oleg was able to reveal that he was also a fully fledged and well-paid KGB spy. Another extraordinary name in Oleg's list of spies recruited by the KGB was Gunvor Harvik, codenamed Greta. She was an elderly secretary in the Norwegian Foreign Ministry who had been spying for the Soviet Union for 50 years by the time Oleg identified her. Another one was Stig Bergling, a former policeman who had risen to become very senior in the Swedish security service. He was a venal spy, if you like. He was doing it for money, and he was doing it on a grand scale. Now, these sorts of names were gold dust to Western intelligence. But they also illustrate a central conundrum of spying, which is that if you have material that is really good, you can't actually use it, because if these spies had simply been swept up by the Scandinavian countries, it would clearly and immediately have made it clear to the KGB that they had a mole in their midst. And it could easily have burned Oleg as a source. So instead of actually arresting them, what they did, the Scandinavian countries, was just to keep an eye on them. They would be arrested eventually, but they let them run in order to see if they could catch them in flagrante with the KGB. Towards the end of his second Danish posting, Oleg met and fell in love with a very beautiful Russian woman called Leyla Aliyev. Now, Leyla was a secretary in the World Health Organization. She was the daughter of two KGB officers. Her father was an Azeri general in the KGB. And so she, too, came from the same sort of stock as Oleg. They fell deeply in love, and they planned to get married. Oleg said he would divorce his first wife, he would marry Leyla, and they would live happily ever after. But this posed a problem, because the KGB, while it was a completely immoral organization, was strangely moralistic when it came to divorce and remarriage. They didn't approve of people breaking up with their wives, and they certainly didn't approve of remarriage as fast as Oleg planned to do it. So he knew that his career was likely to go through at least a hiccup when he went back to Moscow. So before leaving Denmark, he said to his case officer, "I need you to frame an escape plan for me. Just in case, if I get into trouble in Moscow, I want to know that there's a possibility that I can get out." Now, this was an extraordinarily difficult thing to arrange, because nobody had ever escaped from the Soviet Union, let alone anyone like Oleg, who was a fully fledged KGB officer. Because the Soviet Union was really, in many ways, an enormous prison with heavily guarded borders. So the job of trying to frame up an escape plan fell to a very remarkable woman called Veronica Price, who was one of the very few senior women officers in MI6. And she began to attack this problem from every angle. How could they get Oleg out if they needed to? Now, there was one chink in, as it were, the iron wall surrounding the Soviet Union, and that was diplomatic immunity. By convention, not by law, but by convention, diplomatic cars with diplomatic number plates were not searched at borders. They could usually pass through without the Soviet border guards opening them up. Now, I say usually because if the Soviet guards wanted to open up, they would certainly do so and they wouldn't care about convention. But it was potentially a way to get through the Iron Curtain. But, of course, to do that, Oleg would have to be able to send a signal to MI6 that he needed to escape. And so Veronica Price framed up Operation Pimlico, which went, believe it or not, like this. This compound here, known as the Kutz, contained most of the foreign diplomats resident in Moscow at the time, including the MI6 officers. There were two of them and their wives and one secretary. They lived on the corner here. Sorry, there. Opposite it here was a bread shop on the other side of Kutuzovsky Prospect. The escape signal went like this. If Oleg was seen standing on that corner at 7:30 on a Tuesday night, holding a Safeway bag, believe it or not, with a very large red S on it, that would be the signal that he needed to escape. The acceptance signal that MI6 had spotted him and the operation was on was that one of the MI6 officers would walk towards him holding a bag from Harrods, the department store, and eating an English chocolate bar. It had to be either a Mars bar or a Kit Kat. Now, you might think from this plan that Veronica Price had been reading an awful lot of spy fiction. In fact, she had been reading an awful lot of spy fiction. In fact, all spies read an awful lot of spy fiction. Apart from the mafia and the police, I don't know of any group of people that read more about their own imagined path than their own sort of tradecraft. I think one of the reasons it was so elaborate, Operation Pimlico, was that they never, ever thought they would have to use it. On the other hand, every Tuesday night at 7:30 for 7 years, MI6 policed the signal site. They had to make sure that whether there was someone there holding a Safeway bag, whether or not Oleg was in town or not, because they too were under KGB surveillance. All diplomats, all foreign diplomats in Moscow were being very closely watched by the KGB, and so therefore they couldn't alter the pattern of their behavior. If they only checked the signal site, if they were only down at the bread shop when Oleg was in town, when he was in Moscow, that would be a clear pattern of behavior that the KGB would pick up. So rain or shine, wind or snow, every Tuesday, somebody had eyes at 7:30 on that corner. This is an aerial sort of depiction that perhaps gives a bit of a clearer idea. That is the Kutz compound, and that is the signal site, just outside the bread shop. Now, they could either... There was one room here that they could actually see the bread shop from, but otherwise they would have to go down rather elaborately, cross the road here, buy some bread, see if he was there at 7:30, and then go back up again. Or they could try and do it by car, coming back here at the right time. Oleg was under instructions to remain no longer than 30 minutes at the signal site before moving on. That was only the first part of Operation Pimlico. The second part was that once the signal site had been flown and acknowledged, Oleg would have to try and make his way to a particular rendezvous site about 30 miles south of the Finnish border, hide in a lay-by there, screened from the road by a row of trees. At the same time, the MI6 officers would drive in diplomatic vehicles up to the rendezvous site, try and meet up with Oleg on the following Saturday after the Tuesday signal, pick him up, put him in the boot of one of the cars, roll a sort of special heat-reflective blanket around him to try and ensure that they could get through the infrared cameras at the border with the Soviet Union, and then hope that they wouldn't be searched on the way out and get into Finland. In fact, even when they were in Finland, they weren't going to be safe because the Finns were allied with Moscow, and if they'd been caught in Finland, they would still have been arrested and sent back. So Operation Pimlico, as you will gather, was an extremely long shot. Oleg returned to the Lubyanka. He began work there again, but this time he was under a different sort of instructions. He was told by his MI6 handlers, look, if you can get yourself into the British section of the KGB, that will be gold dust. That will mean we will have access to material of the highest quality. So Oleg began to learn English. He learnt it in record time. It took him only a year to learn. And sure enough, he was then deployed to England. Now, before leaving, he began to try to memorize the material that was in the KGB files relating to Britain. They were very voluminous, and some of the things that he found out were very extraordinary. For example, he discovered that Jack Jones, who was then considered to be the most senior trade union official in Britain, he was described by Gordon Brown at his funeral as being the finest trade unionist that Britain had ever produced. Jack Jones was a fully paid up KGB agent called Agent Drim. A second person that Oleg was told to look out for by the British, by the Russians, when he was heading back to Britain, was a man called Ron Brown. Now, Ron Brown was a Scottish Labour MP. You see him here in the middle, looking pretty lit up. He was usually quite drunk. Ron Brown, I'm jumping a little ahead in the story here. Oleg did, in fact, have several meetings with Ron Brown to try and sound him out and see if he could recruit him for the KGB. They got on ostensibly very well, but there was one problem with these meetings, which was that Ron Brown had a very, very strong Scottish accent, and Oleg couldn't understand a single word he said, which meant that he would have these long lunches and then have to return to the KGB station and simply make up what he thought Ron Brown might have said. So we have absolutely no idea whether Ron Brown really was a KGB spy, because his story is hidden behind this impenetrable Scottish accent. The biggest file in the KGB British archive related to someone who was codenamed Agent Boot. And on the cover of the file, a very thick file, 400 pages long, the word agent had been crossed out and confidential contact written in. Now, Agent Boot was Michael Foote. And Michael Foote, by 1981, had risen to become head of the Labour Party in Britain. He was about to go into electoral battle with Margaret Thatcher for the premiership, and there was a decent chance at that point that he could become the next Prime Minister of Britain. What Oleg discovered was that in the 50s and 60s, Michael Foot had had a series of meetings with the KGB, not just one or two, but dozens, and he had been paid a considerable amount of money by KGB offices in London, the equivalent today of about £37,000. So Michael Foot was a key figure in British politics. He still is considered to be a kind of darling of the left, but he had been a paid KGB informant. Now, does that make him a spy? Not really, but does it make him an innocent contact of Russian, ordinary Russian diplomats? It doesn't make him that either. He's something in the middle. When the book came out in Britain about 3 weeks ago, we serialized it in the Times, and it caused a huge political battle, really, because the left, including Jeremy Corbyn and lots of other people, weighed in and said, this is a brutal smear on a man who can no longer defend himself. And the right said, this is proof that Michael Foot, we suspected it all along, was a traitor. Neither of those things is true. Michael Foot sits somewhere on that spectrum, probably somewhere round about the middle. There's a very good Russian term, coined, in fact, by Lenin, polezhny dyurak, which literally means useful idiot. Michael Foot had been very useful to the KGB and completely idiotic in having anything to do with them. Now, when Oleg arrived in London with this very volatile lump of political explosive, it created a huge problem for MI6 because they realized that if anyone got wind of this, particularly if the Conservative Party under Margaret Thatcher got wind of it, it would tip the election the other way. Michael Foot's career would be destroyed in a minute, and the course of history would have been very different. On the other hand, if Michael Foot was elected and the Prime Minister of Britain was known to have been a paid-up KGB agent, that was going to be a real problem. And so a contingency plan was made to inform the Queen if that happened, because it would have represented a major constitutional crisis. In fact, what happened was that MI6 passed the buck. It passed it on to the Cabinet Secretary, who was the chief official in the civil service responsible to Margaret Thatcher, a man called Robert Armstrong, who simply sat on it. He did absolutely nothing with that piece of information and just prayed that Michael Foot would lose the election, which, of course, he did. Now, I said at the beginning that he'd married Layla by this point. They had two little girls, and they settled into London life like ducks to water. They absolutely loved living in Britain. Layla, it has to be stressed, had absolutely no inkling that her father, this rising star in the KGB, was in fact a double agent for MI6 and had been since before they were married. It's the deception that really sits at the heart of this story. Oleg began as a rising star, as I say, within the KGB station in London to produce information of even higher quality. One of the things that he revealed was that, and this is a photograph, by the way, of a demonstration that took place in Korea immediately after the downing of KAL 007, the Korean airliner, that was shot down by Soviet jets at the worst moment of the Cold War, very nearly, since the Cuban Missile Crisis, a moment of intense tension between the two sides. And what Oleg was able to reveal was that the Kremlin genuinely believed the West was planning to launch a first strike, that it was actually planning to press the nuclear button. Now, when this piece of information arrived in Downing Street and in the Oval Office, it came as a huge shock both to Margaret Thatcher and to Ronald Reagan. They hadn't realized that the Kremlin was genuinely fearful that the nuclear war was going to be started by the West. And they immediately began to ratchet down the rhetoric. You can see it. There's a clear pattern that Ronald Reagan stops talking about the evil empire. He stops talking about the danger posed by Russia. And you can begin to see the beginning of the end of the Cold War. So this is an example of what I was saying earlier, that in some cases, spies can actually ratchet down the tension by revealing important evidence to the other side. One of the other things that Oleg did was, when Mikhail Gorbachev came to visit London, came to the West for the first time, the rising figure in the Politburo, everyone tipped him to be the next leader. Before he arrived, Oleg, who had now risen to become head of the political section in London, Oleg's career path was very steep. He was doing extremely well, partly because the Brits kept throwing out his immediate bosses, thus creating a vacancy. In fact, they declared two of them persona non grata until Oleg was very near the top. And by the time Gorbachev arrived, he was about to become head of the KGB in London. Before Gorbachev arrived, the request came through to London for the KGB to produce briefing notes to explain to Gorbachev some ideas about what he might like to say to Margaret Thatcher, what areas of interest should be discussed, bits that should be avoided, possible avenues of agreement and disagreement. Now, and Oleg drew up a very detailed plan for what Gorbachev should say and do. Now, that plan, of course, was actually written by MI6. So you have a completely unique situation here where one spy is actually briefing both sides. Gordievsky was telling Gorbachev what to say to Reagan, to Thatcher, and telling Thatcher what to say to Gorbachev, with the result that Thatcher emerged from those meetings saying, this is a man we can do business with. Well, that was because Gordievsky was rigging the business. Now, I said to you that the information was reaching the Oval Office, and it was. It was going via the CIA. But it was always disguised. MI6 would never reveal to the CIA who their spy was. They were prepared to produce it in quite large volumes. But that is a convention among allies, is that you can pass on information, but you don't have to reveal where it comes from. Now, the CIA doesn't like that. The CIA likes to know where everything is coming from. And so secretly, the CIA launched an investigation to try to find out who the Brits had. And they worked it out. It was rather a brilliant piece of investigation. They did it by working out where the different pieces of information had come from, which KGB officers were where, and they worked out that Oleg Gordievsky must be the Brit source. They codenamed him Tickle, and they tucked this little piece of information into their back pockets. However, what the CIA didn't know was that their own head of counterintelligence, a man called Aldrich Ames, was himself a KGB spy. So you have a very bizarre situation here where the KGB is spying on the CIA, which is spying on MI6, which is spying on the KGB. In May 1985, Aldrich Ames went to the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. and offered to spy for the Soviets. 24 hours later, a cable landed on Oleg Gordievsky's desk in London, commanding him to come back to Moscow. Now, ostensibly, the reason for his summons was that he was going to be anointed as head of the KGB in London. Now, this set off a furious debate within MI6 that still continues today. There were voices that said, Oleg has done noble work, he should be allowed to retire, he should be allowed to stop spying, and he will live under a different name for the rest of his life in Britain. There were other voices saying, we're about to hit the jackpot. If Oleg is anointed as head of the KGB in London, we will literally have access to the safe. We will know everything that the KGB is doing. And in the end, they left it to Oleg himself to make the decision. And Oleg decided that he would go back to Moscow. It was an act of spectacular bravery. The moment he landed back in Moscow, he knew that he was in deep trouble. He went to his apartment and he opened the top lock. He opened the second lock, but he couldn't open the door, because the third lock had been locked. But Oleg Gordievsky didn't have the key to the third lock. He'd never had the key to the third lock. He'd never used that lock, which could only mean that someone had been inside his apartment and had accidentally locked all three locks on leaving. And the only people who could do that were the KGB. So Oleg knew they were onto him. And the man in charge of the hunt for the attempt to trap Oleg was this man, a man called Viktor Budanov, who, believe it or not, runs security today for the American embassy in Moscow, which is an extraordinary thought. He was head of Section K, which was responsible for rooting out potential traitors in the KGB. Now, why did Budanov not simply arrest Gordievsky the moment he landed, since he had information from Aldrich Ames? The answer to that is twofold. One is that Budanov wanted to catch them. He, as had been done with the Norwegian spies before, he wanted to see if he could get Oleg in contact with MI6 and then create an enormous diplomatic firestorm. And secondly, it was complacency. No one had ever escaped from the Soviet Union, as I said, and Budanov firmly believed that no one ever could. Now, Oleg knew he was in deep trouble. He particularly knew he was in deep trouble when he was taken to a dacha in Moscow and administered with sodium pentothal, which is a kind of truth drug. in an effort to try and get him to confess, which is also supposed to cause amnesia. It didn't. Oleg could remember it, but he didn't confess, but he knew he was in trouble. So he now had to decide whether to fly the escape signal. And he had another agonizing choice to make, because his wife and daughters had now been flown out from London. They were with him in Moscow, effectively as hostages. And he had to decide whether to take them with him. MI6 had provision to take them all out. They were going to take two cars up there. The little girls were going to be injected with a kind of sleeping drug. They were then going to try and take them in two cars through the border. And Oleg decided that he could not take his wife and children, that it was simply too dangerous. He also, and he's admitted this in later life, he didn't really trust Leyla. Leyla was a product of the KGB, and he felt that she might turn him into the authorities. So he left them behind. And on July the 15th, 1985, Oleg was standing on the corner of Kutuzovsky Prospect with his Safeway bag. At exactly 4 minutes after the point he was supposed to leave that spot, Arthur G., the younger of the two intelligence officers, spotted him, ran down the stairs with his Mars bar, walked past him eating the Mars bar, and Operation Pimlico was on. As I said before, the plan was that Oleg would go by train and then by bus and then on foot to the rendezvous site, which is roughly here. At the same time, the two MI6 cars would drive up here with diplomatic plates, taking their wives with them, pretending they were going to a hospital appointment in Helsinki. They would then meet at the rendezvous site. That's the lead car, the faster of the two. That was the Saab, driven by the chief of station, a man called Roy Ascott. Then when they would get to the lay-by here, and here's a sort of diagram of it, Oleg, they hoped, would be waiting in this ditch here. The two MI6 cars would try and get in here, pick him up, and then drive on to Vyborg. To cut a very long story short, after a series of incredibly scary adventures, Oleg did make it into this ditch. Meanwhile, and this is now the Saturday, so 4 days after the signal site's been flown, the two MI6 cars are making their way up this highway. They've been bracketed by the KGB. There is one KGB surveillance car in front and two behind them. And 2 kilometers before they reach the turnoff, Roy Ascott was still thinking, I'm going to have to abort this, because unless I can throw off the surveillance, there's no way we can turn into the rendezvous site. By an extraordinary stroke of good fortune, there was a traffic jam. A set of Soviet tanks were crossing the road. And so they all came to a halt, one after the other, in front of this line of tanks. And as the last tank moved off, Roy Ascott and the British cars were much faster than the KGB cars, overtook the car in front, followed by Arthur G. They screamed up this road as fast as they could. And about 200 yards earlier, they worked out, on the spur of the moment, Ascott decided that the KGB were far enough behind that they wouldn't see them as they turned into this turning. They screeched in here, clouds of dust all going on here. They heard the KGB surveillance cars screaming up the road here past the rendezvous site. Oleg emerged from the ditch, covered in mud and bracken and mosquito bites. They were expecting 4 people, bear that in mind. They'd never seen Oleg apart from glimpsing him once on the corner of Kutuzovsky Prospect. They wrapped him in the infrared blanket, stuffed him in the boot of the car, and shot out of here again. That whole pickup took exactly 80 seconds. They then made their way to the border site. And if you want to know what happens next, you're going to have to buy the book. But I will tell you this. 2 hours later, Oleg, cramped in the boot of this car, roastingly hot, covered in sweat, half mad from the tranquilizers that he'd been given, heard a sound that he recognized. I said he was a great classical music aficionado. The driver of the car, Arthur G., put a cassette tape into the cassette recorder and cranked it up to full volume. And what he played was a sound that Oleg knew very, very well. He played Sibelius's Finlandia. And that was the signal that Oleg was in Finland and he was safe. Thank you very much. Thank you. Lovely. Now, we have time for some questions, if you have them, so do please put your hands up. And there are 2 roving mics. There's a gentleman on the left there and one here, too, so we'll do that one.
This
that one
may next. Not be your area of direct expertise, but do you think it's possible that Khashoggi is alive and that this whole thing has been staged, like that situation in Ukraine a while back?
It doesn't look that way to me. The level of incompetence involved in this doesn't make it look like a very well-staged, managed show, if that is what it is. Who knows, really? I mean, I think the explanation put up by Trump that it was somehow a rogue team, who arrived on two private jets all together with plastic bags and a bone saw, that doesn't seem to me very likely. But who knows? I mean, it's a most mysterious operation. What it says to me is that it's open season on journalists and it's open season on spies these days. Yes, sir, there was one.
I'm in KGB. You're writing about spies. We're looking for Oleg. Doesn't it make sense to tail you?
To detain me?
To tail.
Yes, you. They would try to do that. There are very elaborate precautions in place that would make that impossible for them to do. But I won't. I better not explain what those are. But they would find it very, very difficult to get to Oleg through me. That won't happen. In fact, they would find it very difficult to get Oleg full stop. He is now under such heavy security. I mean, there's a permanent guard there the whole time. The house opposite has been purchased by the British Security Service to keep an eye on him. He doesn't even know that. So he's pretty safe. Oleg is also oddly sort of insouciant about this risk. I mean, he's lived with the threat of death for 30 years. He's under an execution order. He has been, ever since he left the Soviet Union, ever since he got out, he was tried in absentia and sentenced to death. That order has never been lifted. So I did ask Oleg when this whole story broke about the poisoning of Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, whether he felt vulnerable. And he was just sort of shrugged and said, I've looked at this before. I don't think I'm in any more danger now than I've ever been. He's a man of extraordinary bravery, Oleg. I mean, he's a very lonely man in lots of ways. He's a prisoner. He can't get out. But then he's always been a most solitary person. He's one of the loneliest people I've ever met. But he's also one of the bravest. He's a very odd combination of parts.
How are you able to get access to the MI6 officers and to Oleg and get all this information that you had for this book?
Well, I wish I could say it was art or brilliance on my part. It was just luck, really. I mean, I began talking to Oleg about 5 years ago. I contacted him, believe it or not, because at that point he was a semi-public figure. You could get hold of his... At the Times, which is my day job, he was on our Rolodex, because he used to write reviews for us in the 1990s and he hadn't changed his email address. And I simply dropped him a note and said, could I come and see you? Now, of course, that note was then intercepted by MI6, who wanted to know exactly what I was doing. And they gave their, I wouldn't say it was their blessing exactly, but they didn't stop me. They could have done. MI6 officers sign this oath, the Official Secrets Act, which means they're supposed never to reveal what they've done in the course of their duties. Every single one of the dozen MI6 officers I spoke to has broken that oath. But they wouldn't have done so if they hadn't been authorized to do so from above. Now, why does MI6 want this story out? I suppose the answer to that is kind of pretty self-explanatory. It worked. Outside of spy fiction, this sort of thing very rarely works. And MI6 is understandably extremely proud of it. So does it therefore become part of a kind of propaganda story? I don't think so. I hope I've not been used to push a certain line. MI6 has never read this manuscript. I think they've read the book now, but they didn't read it before publication. They had no control over it. All they did really was not stop me from writing it or not make it incredibly difficult for me to do so.
I would like to know what techniques that MI6 used to boost Oleg's ascent to become almost the head of the KGB in London.
It's a good question and quite an interesting one. I mean, when Oleg first arrived in London, he wasn't doing very well. His English was not very good. And they realized, and partly because he was spending such a lot of time gathering information for Britain, he wasn't impressing his immediate bosses. So they did two things, really. One was that they began to feed him what is called in the trade chicken feed. Now, chicken feed is information that is true, but not necessarily damaging. So it's stuff that he could have found in open sources, but simply didn't have the time to find. It's like chicken feed, it's bulky, but not particularly nutritious. And so they began to feed him with information that he could then feed back to his Moscow handlers that would make him look very clever and very good. They also did another thing, which was that they fed him access agents. Now, access agents are people who provide access, essentially. Now, these were real individuals in positions of authority in Britain who believed that at MI5 and MI6's behest, they were meeting a KGB officer and feeding him little bits of information. What they didn't know was that he was actually working for MI6, but they were real people that he could then go back to his bosses and say, I've got this source and I've got that source and I've got another one. And Oleg very quickly began to ascend through the ranks. The other thing that I mentioned briefly that they did was they targeted the people immediately above him. Yeah. The first one was Igor Titov, who was his immediate boss in the political section, who was a known KGB operative, and they simply declared him persona non grata and kicked him out of the country, at which point Oleg moved up a space. They then, in a rather brilliant move, got rid of the wonderfully named Gook. Now, Gook was the chief of the KGB in London. He was called Arkady Gook. And they worked out a plan that would enable Thatcher to kick him out. And it went like this. Because an MI5 officer had approached Gook to offer to spy for him and then was exposed, they used that trial as a way of exposing Gook himself, who appeared on the front pages of lots of newspapers identified as Gook the Spook. And they threw him out. And that was the moment when Oleg very nearly, well, he was made head of the KGB in London. So they did it in a variety of different ways. It seems odd, doesn't it, that they would go out of their way to enhance the career of a KGB agent, but they knew what they were doing.
Has Oleg had any communication with his wife and daughter since his defection, and what has happened to them as a result of his defection?
Thank you for that question. Layla, as I said, was completely innocent. She had absolutely no idea what Oleg was up to. And when it transpired that he had defected, she was absolutely astonished and appalled. And for a long time, she refused to believe it. She was hauled into the Lubyanka. She was interrogated. As in most totalitarian regimes, she was assumed to be guilty by association, even though she wasn't. She was ostracized. And she was effectively held under house arrest for 6 years in the Soviet Union. Margaret Thatcher launched an intensive diplomatic project to try and get the family reunited. It was called Operation Hetman. For 6 years, every time British diplomats met with their Soviet counterparts, the question of Gordievsky's family was raised. And eventually in 1991, the family was released. They were reunited, they were brought back to London, and it was after the fall of the Berlin Wall, so it was kind of greeted in the West as a kind of symbolic moment of reconciliation. It was kind of East meets West, everything's going to be fine, and there were these rather strange sort of gauzy photographs of Oleg and Layla sort of wandering through Regent's Park looking terribly happy together. Of course, the reality was completely different. The marriage was holed below the waterline, if you like. The deception that lay at the heart of it meant that it was irrecoverable. And within about 6 months, they split completely and are totally estranged. But even sadder than that, Oleg has no contact whatever with his grown-up daughters. He hasn't spoken to them now for more than a decade. And I suppose that's, in a way, that's the sort of poignant heart of this story. That's the tragedy, because we think of these stories as if they are somehow simple moral fables of good and evil and black and white and the heroes always win and the villains always lose. That's not how life works, and it's definitely not how espionage works. And both Layla and Oleg have paid an enormous human price for this. Their lives, in both cases, were both changed, and I think Layla would say destroyed. Even today, she lives in a safe house, a different safe house, obviously, in a different part of Britain. She's still under MI6 protection. They have a duty of care to her. The girls are grown up, but when you talk to her, she is still, understandably, an extremely bitter woman. She was a loyal Soviet citizen who felt that her life had been wrenched away from her by other people.
At the time that he defected, that and the events that caused him to move in that direction, that probably would have been, I think, the Soviet Union at sort of the height or worst of its totalitarian instincts. But shortly thereafter, the nation started to change. I know what we're looking at today we don't like very much, and it's regressed a lot. But there was a moment when it seemed moving toward some notion of an attempt at Western democracy. As he was observing that, would that have given him pause over his decisions? In other words, the country that he rebelled against, if you were, changed rather quickly, at least for a moment. Did that play with his thoughts about his decisions?
It's true. I mean, I think he felt quite ambivalent about it. I think he felt in one way that history had somehow overtaken him, that the thing that he had sort of fought for had kind of happened organically in some way without him sort of being part of it. On the other hand, I think he also felt an intense pride. I think he felt that one of the reasons why that had happened and one of the reasons that it had happened so quickly was because of his part in it. Oleg is not someone who really does regrets. I've never heard him utter a single word of remorse, apart from his family. That's the thing that he feels bad about. And in a funny way, I think, as you referred to it, you know, the way that Russia has regressed in lots of ways back towards what the KGB was all about. I mean, Vladimir Putin is a former KGB colonel. A lot of what is happening at the moment is straight out of the KGB playbook. I think Oleg, in some ways, feels rather vindicated by that. I mean, he's a ferocious anti-Putin figure. I mean, whenever he's interviewed on it, he's furious about it. So in some ways, I think he sort of feels that kind of history has sort of come round again to meet him. I mean, if you look at what's happening today, I mean, in 1982, when Oleg was sent to London, one of his tasks was what they call active measures. He was supposed to plant fake news. He was supposed to try to affect the election, to change the course of the election, to try and get the candidate that the Soviets wanted elected, Michael Foote, into power, to stop Margaret Thatcher from gaining power, to fiddle with things, to create a kind of miasma of uncertainty. Is any of this familiar to anybody here? You know, in lots of ways, you know, it's not a completely different world. But there was a moment, there was a considerable period when Oleg was a sort of semi-public figure. Between the moment of his defection in 1985 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, he was paraded around the world as a kind of expert on the KGB, and he visited Australia, New Zealand, and he visited CIA headquarters in Langley to tell them, you know, what he knew. And by sheer appalling irony, one of the people sitting across the table from him, on the other side of the table, nodding very politely, a man who he thought exemplified all the great virtues of American democracy, was Aldrich Ames, the man who had actually sent him, he thought, to his death. Ames was eventually captured, but it took a very long time. He was only caught in 96. Yes?
You use the term useful idiot. Did that usually pertain to, were that mostly political people? And I was wondering if there was anybody that begs for comparison.
Interesting.
In the States right now.
I wonder who you could be talking about. The I think the noun applies, definitely. Whether he's any use, I've no idea. Mostly political people. Useful idiots were often journalists, opinion formers, trade unionist officials, anyone who could sort of massage opinion or who could have information planted on them. I mean, that's really what was done with Michael Foote. It wasn't that he was producing vital secrets, nuclear codes. He didn't have access to any in the 1950s and 60s. But what the Soviets were very good at, and Mikhail Lyubimov, the man I was referred to earlier, was brilliant at this, it was planting ideas. Comrade, here's a very good thing that you might want to write about in the papers. Here's a subject, you know, the steel production in Kazakhstan is 10 times what it was. Why don't you write an article about that? Why don't you give a speech about that? So it's planting information. And I mean, idiot seems to me the word, because the people who went along with this must have known that they were dealing with KGB officers. I mean, when this all came to light and Michael Foote was still alive, he was asked about it and he said he never knowingly met with any KGB officers. Well, if he didn't know that these 36 meetings involved KGB officers, then he was staggeringly naive. We probably have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I was just wondering if there was any further part of the story that involved the Czech fellow Kaplan. Did he play a role in the 1980s with any of the things that were going on with Oleg?
He did, although he settled in Canada, and he is still in Canada. I've never been able to track him down, but he became an insurance agent in Canada. But he was an expert on the structure of the Czech intelligence service, which was a pretty formidable operation, and absolutely when the Velvet Revolution happened in Czechoslovakia, he was one of the key informants for both the CIA and for MI6 on that. So he continued to play an important part, as did quite a lot of the quite a lot of the defectors. There's one story which I'll finish on, which I did sort of want to tell you because it always makes me laugh, which is that when Operation Pimlico was flown, when the Safeways bag was spotted, and when London learnt that it was all going, there was still one part of the jigsaw that had to fall into place, which was that it had to be authorised by Margaret Thatcher herself. Now, Margaret Thatcher knew about the case. She never knew Gordievsky's identity until he was out. She always knew him as Mr. Collins for some reason that I've never been able to work out. But she greatly admired him. But the weekend that the Pimlico signal was flown, she happened to be staying with the Queen in Balmoral. By convention, British Prime Ministers spend a few days a year on holiday, theoretically, with the Queen in Balmoral. It's a kind of long-standing convention. Now, Margaret Thatcher didn't actually like staying with the Queen and always insisted on staying in a kind of wooden hut in the garden rather than in the main palace. But on the weekend in question, that was where she was. Now, it was obviously this was all far too secret to be done on the telephone, so her private secretary, a man called Charles Pole, secretly nipped out of the back of 10 Downing Street without telling anyone where he was going, took a flight to Scotland, where Balmoral, the Queen's summer residence in Scotland. In fact, it was so secret, his taking of this plane, that he couldn't get his expenses reimbursed afterwards when he tried to explain what he was up to. He got to Scotland, he drove in the car, he hired a car, drove to the great castle, Balmoral, got to the gate, where an equerry was on the telephone, and the portcullis was down, and a little sort of glass box. And the equerry was doing a very important piece of royal business, which he was trying to arrange for the Queen to borrow the Queen Mother's videotape recorder in order to watch an episode of Dad's Army. And for 20 minutes, while the private secretary was standing there tapping his foot and looking at his watch, the equerry continued to have this conversation. And it's held up everything at a critical moment. Eventually, Charles Pole got in, found Margaret Thatcher sitting in bed, surrounded by her red boxes, which contain her official papers. And she immediately gave her authority for Operation Pimlico to go ahead. What she didn't know, and I think she never knew this, Margaret Thatcher, was that, in fact, Operation Pimlico was already underway. Oleg was already on his way to the rendezvous point in Finland. The MI6 officers were on their way. Operation Pimlico was unstoppable. And if she'd said, we have to stop it, the MI6 officers might have been able to stop, but Oleg would have been left in that ditch. He would have been captured by the KGB. He would have been tortured. He would have been executed. And this book would never have been written. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.